You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky. I am here with my co-hosts. They are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hello.
Greetings, Max. Who was the guest on the show this week?
This week, I talked to Willa Paskin. You guys know Willa Paskin?
I do.
She, for a long time, was the TV critic at Slate. Before that, she was the TV critic at Salon. Before that, she was an editor and writer at Vulture. But now, and for the last several years, she has been the host of a podcast called Decoder Ring from Slate. Decoder Ring, every episode is a deep dive into some cultural mystery that Willa is trying to unlock. The range of topics on the show is like almost infinite. It's everything from like hydration to Celino and Barnes to what impact did Sideways actually have on the wine industry to all kinds of things. I love the show. I've been listening to it for a long time, and it was a real pleasure to talk to her both about how she makes the thing. She's actually working on the next season now. It comes out April 12th, but also how she thinks about TV now, which has changed a lot, and how those two things talk to each other, and how doing Decoder Ring is a lot like criticism, which was not a thing that I would have thought before I talked to her.
I kind of stopped. Everything you said after Celino and Barnes was competing in my brain with Celino and Barnes.
Injury attorneys. 1-888-8888.
I want to clarify something from last week's introduction because we got some reader mail about this. I don't actually feel like I wasted the last decade of my life on the show. That was a joke.
I feel like that's the first correction in the history of the show.
You said it with such passion, I think.
I have nothing but gratitude for my time as the host of this show. And I was simply making jokes, as is my role in the introductions to this program, which is produced in partnership with Vox Media. Thanks to everyone over at Vox.
And now here's Max with Willa Paskin.
I love you guys. Hi, Willa.
Hi, Max.
Thanks for coming on the podcast.
I'm really so happy to be here, genuinely. I'm excited.
I'm really so happy, genuinely, for you to be here. I feel like it's a long time coming. Here is a thing that I'm excited about. So oftentimes people come on the show, right? And the first question is like, how'd you get started writing? You are the rare guest who has written an article entitled Why I Became a TV Critic.
Oh my God, did I? Like, Max, I don't know the article. I'm sure I know what it says, I think, but I don't know it.
Well, I think this should be a test because I know what it says because I just read it. You wrote it in 2016.
Okay.
So let's go back in time. Okay. What did 2016 Willa Paskin think was the reason she became a TV critic?
I think it's because I wanted to know why people care about the things that they care about. And also because I watched so much TV when I was a kid. Was this like around Donald Trump time? Like, what was the occasion of this piece?
Donald Trump was not yet president. It was January 2016. But I must tell you, that was not the reason why 2016 Willa became a TV critic.
Oh, this is the thing. I just found it.
There's no Googling allowed in this exam.
I'm sorry. You came prepared. I'm like bringing my class materials to the test. Oh, yeah. No, this is all about anthropology and everything, right? Is that what it's about?
It's a classic Willa construction. Now I've spent a lot of time in the last like week. I've read a lot of pieces. I've listened to a lot of Decoder Ring. There is a kind of classic Willa construction, which is we start with young Willa and her interest in anthropology, but it lands in a different place. and with a relatively clear conclusion. And in this case, your answer to why you became a TV critic was timing.
Really? I kind of think that. You know what's so funny, actually? Firstly, I'm very flattered that you just said there was, like, a will of form. I really like talking to people because they say things to you that you would never think yourself. Like, this is the joy of talking to people. This is why it's so fun to interview people. And I just, like, that was nice to hear. Yeah, I mean, I would say with any piece of writing or podcast or anything, like, there is some artifice because you are making a structure. So it's possible that that piece about why I became a TV critic is like a little cleaner and more argumented than the reality. But I do think timing did actually have a lot to do with why I became a TV critic, as did my interest in anthropology. Both of those things are part of the story.
Well, now there's so many places we could go. I'm very interested in the gap between the polished idea and the real thing. I'm pretty interested in your childhood obsession with anthropology, but I think for the purpose of the long form podcast, it might be helpful to go back even further in time to when you were just out of school and starting to think about television and why timing is the answer for why, at least for a little while, you became a TV critic.
Sure. So I think it's important to know that, like, I grew up not watching a ton of TV. It was kind of like the thing that made my mom totally insane.
I feel like that's the real answer.
Oh, no, like that is. I was like that and I like thought it was like naughty. I think that's like the Freudian true answer. So I watched a lot of TV and I was really interested in it. Like, I really just liked it. And it was a lot of boilerplate sort of teen shows like 90210 and everything on the WB. But I watched a lot of other stuff. And I went to college and it was at this time when this project that now is like so pedestrian and that was not really new then, but was sort of just like actually getting really popular, of just being like, we're coming for the highbrow. Like, what is this high? There's no difference. Like, we are going to spend so much time thinking about pop culture and as seriously as anyone ever thought about the high arts. Like, we're coming. Like, it's topsy-turvy. And I mean, I was like, people had already been doing that. It's like a Gen X project. I'm right on the cusp, like. But it felt like, especially in television, it felt really new, right? Like, Television Without Pity, which was like this early recapping site where people would write these, like, honestly 20,000 words full of nicknames for every single character about every episode. But it was like they were all geniuses. Like, it just, it was really like, it just felt like it was happening. Like, Buffy was on, The Sopranos had just started, but it wasn't, you know, it was like still very like in that, is TV the new novel? Like, and that was like a novel thing to say kind of moment, instead of like a just roll your eyes and go to sleep kind of thing. And so there was just like all this energy around it. And I just was like, I want to be a TV critic. Like, I want to do what Pauline Kael did for movies about television. I was just very interested, and I don't think this is unique to me, in like trash culture. Like, I was interested in TV and some of it wasn't good and I knew that, but I loved it. I was like interested in tabloids. I mean, there was no way that I was unique in that. Like, there was a lot of people like spending a lot of time thinking about Us Weekly and sort of trying to take guilty pleasures back by overthinking about them, kind of. And I think what I got lucky about and what is true about the timing is that I really thought, and I was really interested in this question, which was related to sort of anthropology, which is like, why do people care about the things they care about? And I was like, I'm interested in that question, and it doesn't matter to me if the product is good or not. It doesn't matter if the TV show is good. We can think interesting things, even about something that's bad or mediocre or just popular. But what I think like timing really helped me luck out is it's more fun to think about things that are good. Like, it is actually more nourishing. And this is like we can get into this because this is sort of pertains to why I think in some ways I became less interested in being a TV critic. But I did like luck into this moment where TV just got better. It did. And so there was a lot of things to think about that were popular and that were interesting and that people cared about a ton, but that like also were kind of felt like worth thinking about, not just because they were like weird cultural objects or like bad cultural objects that people loved anyway. And I think that was really sustaining, basically. I think that's sort of like how I stayed interested in it for as long as I did.
Can you stay in the time machine with me for a second?
Yeah.
And just try and think about how your like critical eye developed? How did the way that you watch, how did the way that you thought about shows and about the medium, how did that refine?
You know, I thought a little bit about this thinking about talking to you because I don't actually know that I have a good answer because I think some of this is like, probably this is my personality, like in the sense of like I think, like I was basically thinking about it in the context of more like I make a podcast now where like I kind of try to explain things. And I think that there's a way that like explaining things seems like even I want to roll my eyes. I'm just like, oh, my God, another person trying to explain things. And then I'm like, oh, but I just like think that's who I am. You know, like I think I just was kind of always like not trying to explain things, but like wanting to understand them and like communicate a way of thinking about them and explain them, like that I'm just like kind of a criticky person. and I maybe always have been. I don't remember some like moment where it clicked in. Like I just think my brain does a little bit work this way. Like, isn't it so weird that I was like 19 and I was like, I really want to be a TV critic? Like I can't explain that to you, but it is true.
I think what I'm interested in is wanting to be a TV critic at 19 and actually pulling it off. That seems hard.
I know. It makes me, I honestly, I'm like self-conscious. I'm like, I should have wanted to be a Supreme Court justice. Like, what could I have willed into the world? Like, a little bigger. Think a little bigger.
Well, part of the reason I started with that piece you wrote in 2016 is because the sort of thesis of it is that if there hadn't been this kind of highbrow TV wave, maybe you would have just like wanted to be a TV critic for a couple months after college and then had gone and done something else.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, the thing that did happen after college is I wasn't a TV critic right away. Like I'm from New York. I went back to New York and I like waitressed and interned at a bunch of places, including at Us Weekly. And then I ended up at Vulture after like a bunch of stops. And like, I think if TV had been boring by then, I just like would have been a culture writer. I would have been a culture critic or I would have been an editor. Like, I think I would have, by that point, I was in the world enough that I would have just, I might have been a generalist. I might have just been an editor. But the fact that I had this like, oh, I've always wanted to do this. And by that point, it had like been going on long enough that it ended up sort of being determinative.
Do you have fond memories of your time at Us Weekly?
No, I don't, but like that is itself a fond memory. Like I do, like, so as I said, like lowbrow trash culture really interested. And I like loved reading tabloids and I was like, I knew enough to be like, it's kind of embarrassing, but I also knew enough to be like, you're lame if you think this is embarrassing, like get with it, everybody. And so I went, it was owned by Jan Wenner. It was in the same office as Rolling Stone on 6th Avenue in the 50s. And, it was hellacious because we basically just transcribed 4-hour interviews with Bachelor contestants. Like, I'm kind of, like, they were doing things, but, like, that's, like, was a big part of the job was, like, just they would, they were just trying to get anything good and interesting. And they were really, the staff there was, like, working super hard and, like, a ton of reporting. But the job for me was, like, literally transcribing like 4-hour interviews with like the 6th guy to get kicked off The Bachelor. And we would go to Times Square and like have to ask people, do like the like who wore it best surveys. And I would ask like 10 people. And I was just so mortified that then I would like go to the Mid-Manhattan Library and like read like new journalism as like to like insulate myself and then just extrapolate out the answers. But it was like, I mean, there were things that were super fascinating about it. I mean, I learned like they really fact check a lot of things in a way. So it was like, I mean, there's language things, but it's like if they said something happened, like it probably happened, you know, if they said like alleged or like as told, you know, they had ways of sort of making it seem like it happened. But if they were like going to be like, this happened, like they checked it. And they really worked so hard. And there was obviously so much stuff I didn't know anything about, like tip lines or whatever. But I was just like kind of, I just basically honestly like had this experience, not for the last time, where I was like, oh, there is a lowbrow that's too low for me, and like I have encountered it, and like that's not necessarily like that's a snobby thing to say, but I was like, it was good to like have that. I think I think it was like clarifying, you know. I was like, okay, I mean, I was also like a shy, quiet, uncomfortable. Like, I just, it wasn't like a great fit, but I don't, you know, and they were really busy. Like, it was Janice Min times. Like, they were working. They were there all the time. Like, you'd walk in, there'd be, the floor would be like papered with printouts from Getty of all like the red carpet stuff. You know, like, they were just very busy. Like, it was, in a serious way. And I was just like, oh, this is working too hard on this for me. Like, this is not the material that I like want to be. Not that like they were like, oh, have a job. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was no, I didn't impress anyone there.
It wasn't like you were like, this kind of grinding is anathema to me. You were like, grinding this hard on this material is not something I want to do.
Yes. And actually, I mean, I've worked at magazines where we grinded that hard, and it was really fun. I mean, it was hard, but it was super fun too. So it wasn't that part. Like, the collective working hard when you're inside a magazine is so intoxicating, you know? Even though you're also like, this is horrible and dysfunctional, and I'm not, never see the sun. But like, it's fun, you know? It's fun to make things with people.
Is that the New York Magazine time of your life?
No, it was actually Radar.
Radar?
Yeah. So Radar was like my first job. So before Radar became a tabloid owned by the National Enquirer or whatever it's owned by. So what happened? So I finished college. I interned at a bunch of places. And then I ended up working at Variety as like an assistant. Like, I compiled like the theater box office numbers. And I went to a ton of red carpet premieres, which was actually really awesome experience, not just because it was parties, but I just had to learn how to go to a party by myself. There's some of these things that are so mortifying. Like,
did you ever have to do like red carpet reporting?
Yes, that's what I was doing. You just stand on the red carpet and you talk to people.
I think that's the worst thing I ever did as a nominal journalist.
Who'd you do it for?
I don't even remember. I did it one time. It was like, I can never do that again.
Yeah. I mean, it's very, yeah, totally. 100. It was good because what I needed to get was like very, it didn't have to, like, I didn't have to ask anyone embarrassing questions, and they knew it was Variety, so they weren't like that mad at me. And I really did find it very interesting. Like, that was pretty interesting to me. And then also we would go to the parties afterwards, which were like, this was been in the mid 2000s, so people still had money. So like, they were just so swanky, which was fun in and of itself. And then also just to learn how to like be at a party where you don't know anybody. And obviously, like, sometimes you pretend to talk on your phone because it's like so uncomfortable. You just like have to fake conversation. Like, you know what I mean? Like, just, I would do that. But then you start to know people and you figure out how to do it. And I mean, I'm never going to be a person who's really good at just like cold approaching someone. But like, it was really good experience in just reporting, but also just like being in a space where you're just like, what? Okay, I just have to make the best of this. I have to figure out how to spend 45 minutes here. And it can't just be eating egg rolls, you know?
We're jumping all over the place, but do you have any tips for people who find themselves alone at an uncomfortable and or swanky party of what to do aside from talk to yourself on the phone?
I mean, you're just like supposed to go talk to someone. You just have to like go make conversation with anyone that you see. You basically like, you start making small talk like over the buffet table, and like some people will like literally run away from you. Do you know what I mean? Because there's other people are anxious, you know, they won't do it. And then other people will chat with you. And the thing that starts to happen at those is mostly that I just would end up talking to other journalists because they're the people that you recognize. And that was fun, you know? And like, there was this one time, I think it was like, it was the Fantastic Four premiere, and it was on Liberty Island, like with the Statue of Liberty. And I don't remember. I think it rained. Basically, we all, like the journalists, we all like got stuck for hours getting there and then on Liberty Island. And it was like a one night, and I made like the fastest friends with these three other journalists. And we had like baby journalists, and we had like the best time. It was honestly like the beginning of a TV show. We're like, and then they're friends forever. I mean, we literally don't ever speak. We never spoke again. We like met once. But it was just like it's just like stuff like that. It's like, it's barely about them. It was really fun and interesting. But given that we're in the chronology, what happened is basically, if I had known more people or understood, I probably could have parlayed that into a job, because Variety was like, oh, like that's a daily paper. Like, it was sort of, people were like impressed with it enough, but I didn't know anything or anyone. So I went to journalism school.
Oh, you went to journalism school then?
Yeah. So I went to journalism school about like 2 years after college. I went specifically to NYU's cultural reporting and criticism program because I wanted to be a TV critic, right? And I was there for a year and a half. I met my husband, so like, I can't complain. And that is how I ended up at Radar because someone who, a student who'd also been there, ended up at Radar, and I started writing capsule reviews for them, and it ended up turning into a job. And that was my first, like, grown-up job, and that was, like, a full print magazine, and I had the whole print magazine experience, which was really awesome.
Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Aside from meeting your husband, what are your feelings now about J School?
I think it's very in life, right? Like, one thing leads to another, right? So, like, you live your life, and this thing led to that thing and led to that thing. And journalism school is one of those things. Like, it led to a lot of things. It led to that job at Radar. I mean, there's many things in my life that trace back to that. So it's hard to be like, I wouldn't do it. I think the other thing is that I didn't have to pay for it. Like, I got a full ride. So, which, like, is a, I feel embarrassed to say, because, like, it feels, am I bragging? Maybe I'm bragging, but mostly I'm saying, like, a lot of the, like, the calculus, the calculations of journalism school were not, like, present in my circumstance. So, it doesn't, I'm not, like, the problem is that it's not a trade school like being a lawyer or a doctor. You don't have to go to journalism school to be a journalist. And so it just cannot give you those things. It cannot give you the thing. Like, it's just so much fuzzier than that. And I think that that's a real recipe for leaving people unsatisfied sometimes. But it also, like, did, I met a bunch of people, you know? And it didn't, meeting those people didn't feel like the way I thought it would. Like, connections didn't feel like how I thought they would feel. I think I thought they would feel concrete, or like, I really know that person, I can call them. I mean, I think they feel like that now, but at the time they really, really didn't. I was like, I have no, this isn't helping at all. But it, of course it did. You know, it's like, you, even if it's just the kids you're in school with, which actually is exactly the people that ended up being important.
I do think you're bragging, but it's—
You think you're okay, then cut it out.
That was a joke. That was a joke. I'm just kidding. I'm just giving you shit. I don't think you're bragging at all.
Like, you just really, like, you're like, okay, I was bragging. Take it out.
No. We're leaving that in, and we're leaving this in. But B, I was just genuinely giving you shit, because the thing I was going to actually say is that completely changes every equation about J school. The whole thing is the money that you have to pay to get that experience, which maybe you need or maybe you don't need, is that worth it? Essentially, when part of the value is those connections. But if you don't have to pay for it, then it's all pretty valuable.
Yeah, right. Yes. I mean, I think the thing about J school is, like, if you don't know how to proceed, like, it's a great way to proceed, you know?
Can you talk a little bit more about the gap between how those connections felt at the time and what a real connection feels like?
Do you know what you do know what I mean? Like, so I just feel like it's also like, you know, like, people have mentors, like, they're like, I have a mentor, like, even in college. And I just be like, what? Like, you have a grown up that you, like, talk to that's a prof— like, I just didn't have that. I just couldn't. I mean, I didn't ever try to cultivate it. I just, like, didn't. It was not like in my toolkit of things that I could do or knew how to do particularly. And there was a way that, like, J school sort of felt. And not just J school, like, all this stuff sort of feels similar. It's like, what does it mean to have a connect? I think I thought having a connection was, like, really tangible. It was like, this person's going to do this thing for me. And that's not at all what it is, right? Now, like, 20 years later, I'm like, oh, right. Connections are, like, just literally, like, having the person's correct email format. Do you know what I mean? Like, in a way, or like someone else to ask for their email. Like, I think I just have a different idea of what they are. But I remember in journalism school being like, this is not connections. And then in hindsight, it's like, oh, maybe it was the beginning of them. And actually, this is the other thing about J School. It's related to this, is that obviously, like, journalism and especially a certain kind of reporting, like, really rewards people, or not rewards people. It seems suited to people who don't need, like, that kind of reassurance, who are just like, it's cool, I'm going to, like, you know, newspaper got, like, reporters used to be like, they didn't go to J school. They, like, were 17 years old and they were like, I'm going to go string for, like, whatever. Right. Like, I'm going to go knock on every door. And so you're like, so there's a way that just, like, being like, yes, I need someone to tell me what to do in this field where, like, the whole thing is you have to make it up, like, can feel sort of like, it sort of feels like self-conscious or just, like, even at odds with, like, the thing you're going to do next. But I just think not everybody is comfortable right away just being like, I'm going to make it up. You know, like, some people want to know how to proceed or just have, like, some help proceeding or some just, like, framework.
Some guidelines somewhere.
Someone. Yeah, totally. Just think something to even just, like, you know, just, like, right, just like a first draft to play around with.
All right, let's move ahead. You ready to move ahead?
I'm ready.
When is the point when you decided the thing that I want to be doing is writing full time, not editing, not jumping in different ways in a magazine? When did, like, I'm going to be a TV critic, that is what my focus is going to be? When did that happen?
So Radar folded. I went and worked a bunch of places. It was actually great. I worked at Slate. I worked at this place called Black Book, which was less great, but was really instructive in a bunch of ways. And I ended up at Vulture. And I was hired as a blogger, like a full-time main blogger. I was writing 8 posts a day. And I really loved it. Like, I loved Vulture. Like, I loved the people. I loved the voice. Like, I really, it was like a great home. I had a great time. And I was there long enough that I got promoted to sort of like being like deputy at, like, it was a more high up at the site. Was still writing a bunch, but I was like, you know, not writing 8 posts a day. And then there was just, like, basically a game of TV critic musical chairs, which is that Emily Nussbaum, who had been the TV critic at New York, went to The New Yorker, and Matt Zollersites, who'd been the TV critic at Salon, went to New York and Salon, where I had actually interned, needed a TV critic. And I had, as we know, like, wanted to be a TV critic since I was 19 years old. And I had written, you know, I'd been writing a bunch of TV criticism for Vulture. I'd been writing other things, too, but, like, I had definitely been writing TV criticism. And so I went after that job, and I got offered that job, and I, you know, I was like, I've been wanting to be a TV critic for a long time. I guess I'm going to go do this. I mean, the thing is that I have observed is that as you get older, like, job offers get more and more painful, because I think things start to be, like, if you hate your job, it's one thing. But, like, if you kind of like your job, it's like the tyranny of small differences or something. Like, you're just like, oh, this, it, you just, like, you just can feel, you're like, I don't want to leave this and this and this. Like, this is so scary. And this other thing's not offering me anything that different. And it starts to get more and more torturous. And I was pretty tortured by that change, because I just really liked New York. But it was probably, like, the last one I was like, I know the answer. I should try to do this. I've been wanting to do this. So I did. And so I went to Salon.
What does going after a job look like?
Oh, I mean, I applied for the job at New York and I didn't get it. Like, I did a bunch of pieces for them, which ended up actually being good pieces that were helpful to me in other ways. I think I emailed the then editor-in-chief of Salon, whose email, of course, I had because I had been an intern and he knew who I was, and, like, talking about connections. And I probably went in for a couple interviews, but it was not, I think they were like, yeah, we know who you are. Let's work it out.
Yeah. And then you were there for a while and moved to Slate?
I was there for about a year or so. And in that time, Dan Coyce at Slate had me come down to South by Southwest for a Slate panel with about, like, the future of TV, which actually was really interesting because we was a panel with this guy who had a app that was, like, sort of like a second screen app. It was, like, before it was obvious that Twitter was going to do all that and there didn't need to be a second screen app. But he was really – this conversation is very memorable because we sort of got in a little back and forth where he was like, no, if it's popular, it is good. And I was like, no, it's just popular. Like, it was just like a real like, and I think Dan was like really chuffed by that, basically. They eventually were like also sort of looking for a TV critic because I think there was just like people moving around. And so like they got in touch with me about that. And I was like, yeah, I would love to come work at Slate.
And when was that? What year are we talking about?
Honestly, I think it was 10 years ago.
Wow.
I know. It's crazy.
God, we're so old.
Also, just like, I feel like that's a long time to be somewhere in our business now.
Yeah, it is a long time. Do you think that 10 years ago, Willa would have expected to still be there?
I don't know. Like, I definitely didn't think about that. I mean, I think maybe. Like, that's the thing also, Max, about having been like, I really want to be a TV critic, is that then, like, that happened, and then you're like, oh, well, I don't have, like, it's not that I don't have other things I want to do, but it was very, like, nebulous. You know what I'm saying?
What do you do after you do the thing you wanted to do is a pretty big question.
I guess you make a podcast.
I guess so. And I can't believe we've gotten this far without talking about the podcast, but I got one more beat on the TV critic era before we moved to Decoder Ring, which is basically like you did the thing. You got the job. You got the job like multiple times, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
That wave basically from when you started to want to write about TV to 2016, 2020, the amount of good television, ambitious television that was on the air was going up and up and up and up and up that whole time. But at some point, your relationship to it changed. And I'm interested in what that change was and then how podcasting fit in.
Yeah. I mean, just totally truthfully, like this, I could talk about this a really long time because I am still like sorting it out in my mind. And I think basically I'm supposed to write a really big piece about this, like even just for myself. So every time I talk about it, I'm like, am I getting closer to like writing this essay? I basically feel like a TV apostate now. Like I kind of hate it. And that's like overstating it, but not completely. I mean, there's a lot to say. I mean, one of the things is just like, listen, writing about anything, any art form over and over and over again is like, God bless the people that are really, really still interested in it. I'm actually in awe of them. I think TV specifically, like particularly does not lend itself to that for a number of reasons. One, like it's not like, you know, Peter Sheldahl, you're like, oh my God, every time you wrote a piece, like you knew so much, but also you had to go like learn about the 1400s or the 800s or like 1930s. And like, these people are all geniuses. Like there's so much, like art history is so rich. It's so long. Like every time you're like dropping into things that are like so vibrant and fascinating. And TV's history is much shorter than that. Additionally, TV itself is really long. Let's say you're a movie critic. You want to watch something. It's going to take 3 hours of your life at most, and it will be finished. And you can have a whole thought about that whole thing. And television is really long. It's just really long. And the structural things that were happening with TV, sort of the invention of streaming, basically meant that suddenly TV critics were getting, we were getting all of it. Like, we used to get, like, a network show, you'd get like an hour of you'd get the first two episodes, maybe. Do you know what I mean? And you'd review that, which is insane. Like, that's an insane thing to do, but it would take 2 hours. Now you get 10 hours. Like, you get the whole thing. Like, you feel, you're like, well, I guess I have to watch the whole thing. Or maybe you don't, but you're just like, oh my God, then that's, and so before I had children, watching TV in the middle of the day for 4 hours or whatever the day I had to watch the House of Cards, like, I was like, that was fun. Like, who cares? Like, I just watch TV for 6 hours in the middle of the day. Like, I don't have time to watch TV 6 hours right. In the middle of the day. And it doesn't feel good to me. It feels gross. So, like, I think that was just, I think actually, like, basically what I'm saying is the peak TV, the moreness got a little bit relentless.
Yeah.
And also, in any medium, most things are not that good or they're fine. And you just, if you have to watch a lot of stuff, not just like a regular person, right? So not just what you're interested in, you end up having to watch a lot of stuff you're not that interested in. And as a critic, your job is to think interesting things about those things you're not that interested in. And for a long time, having to do that made them interesting. But it sort of stopped for a lot of stuff. Like, if there was something that was really good or new, I could do it. But I was like, oh, I've actually seen like 100 of these. You know what I mean? Like, I really know what's happening here. And I've like written about this a lot. And the thing that started to happen was like, I could tell I was getting bitter about it and snarky. And that's not the right place to be coming from, you know? Like, especially now, it's like people want you to be insightful and incisive, but I think they also, like, they actually, you know, people read reviews of things they like, of things they're interested in. And to just like be coming from just a really negative place, or like not even, I don't think it always bled into my writing at all, actually. But I just like think I could tell where I was like, I'm coming from the wrong place.
You knew it.
Yeah, I knew it. I was also just like, it's a lonely thing. You know what I mean? This is the thing about writing. It's like, you're just with your brain, and that can be really fun. And then when it stops being fun, you're just with your brain, right? So it was like, so it just was like, oh, like I'm just spending a lot of time alone watching TV and like writing about it. I'm done with that.
Do you think there was any aspect, aside from not being able to escape your own brain, that had to do with the project that had felt exciting at the beginning being complete? Like, I feel like there was this energy when you were talking about when you got into it that you were like part of a thing that was making the case for this. And then like the jury ruled, TV's legit, everyone agrees. Do you think that had any aspect of it?
100%. I feel like we were like, we've got to take TV seriously. It's art. It can be all those things, which I believe. And then like, kind of like we're gilding the lily now. Like, I just, like, TV is the most popular, powerful medium that had ever existed before the internet. Like, it's like, it's just not an underdog. Like, the only place it was an underdog was like, as like, should we take it seriously as art? And so we were like, no, we have to take it seriously as art. And then like, I just feel like there was like a de-emphasis on its deep overdogness, which, and so now we're in the situation where like, it gets to have it all. Like, we take it really seriously, even though a lot of it is shitty, and even though like it is a huge, like, Fox News is a literal, real, like, honest to God actual disaster, and it gave us Trump, and like just like it not, like, just dealing with the art product, like, kind of short sells. Like I think it's like a little bit myopic about like what TV is, and then also I just think like, there was like a lot of structural forces that made this period that's just passed interesting about television, but I think a lot of them might have been blippy. I think we think of TV as everything. We tend to think in terms of things as progressing, as making progress. And I think like the history of television tells us like people will basically watch what's on, and it's great if it's good, but like people can get really into Twin Peaks, like it's happy, you know, but that a lot of people just watch what's on. And there was this moment where it was like, oh, everyone's really excited about things that are good. They're excited about The Sopranos. They're excited about Orange is the New Black. They're talking about Girls. I mean, you know what, like, pick your show. And it's like, oh, I think weirdly Netflix is just like, oh no, people will just watch what's on. And like, that doesn't mean that critics shouldn't be like, here's what's actually good and not. But it's a little bit, it was like a little distorting. And I still watch some TV shows, you know? And I'm sure I will. And it's real, I like picking them now. Like, when it's something I want to watch. But like, we are still in like a, we're not seeing each other that much right now phase, you know? We're a little done.
Are you able to turn your brain off when you're watching TV?
Yes and no. Like, I think, yes, basically. But like, does that mean that if I didn't turn my brain on, like, 2 minutes after I turned it off, I couldn't figure out what to write about it? Like, yes, of course I could do that.
Those muscles don't go away.
I just think it was always a part of how I was watching everything, always. Like, watching something and be like, oh, you have to say something about it is not, like, that part is kind of, like, comes naturally. I mean, not that I don't have, like, not that it doesn't have to be refined a huge amount and it's, like, garbage, which is, like, a place to start. Like, it comes pretty naturally.
Okay, can we talk about Decoder Ring?
Yeah, totally. It's connected, so let's do it.
I can't believe how long it has taken for me to get to the show, because I'm a big fan. I have a lot of questions about how you make this thing. Can you give the like very short description of what Decoder Ring is?
Yeah, it's a show about cracking cultural mysteries where the mysteries are extremely largely construed. So it's just like, so listen, the job of a critic is to take an object and to say, be like, say something interesting about it. Like, that's what a critic's job is. And I think that is actually also like Dakota Ring's job. It's like, take something, say something interesting about it, but make an argument. Like, make an argument and try and say something they haven't heard before about this thing. And we do organize it like around a question. Like every episode is like, what happened to the laugh track? Why don't we eat blue food? Like, or they can be really specific, you know, like they aren't always questions you've always been wondering about. Basically, they can, we sort of retrofit them to like the actual topic at hand. But they are organized around a question. So I think it can feel like we're on a hunt, like we're solving a mystery more than it sometimes feels like when we're actually making them.
How do you pick those topics? How do you find the either real mysteries that you want to solve or the questions that you have a thought about and want to back into?
I think this is a little bit of like the show's like special sauce slash like Achilles heel, which is that there isn't, I don't know, is like the simple way to answer that question. And the
appreciate that answer because that's kind of one of my favorite things about it is like it just feels like it could be anything.
No, that's what I mean when I say I think it's a special sauce. Like I think it's like, you're like, oh, I didn't know that could be a Dakota Ring. And then we say, it's a Dakota Ring. And you're like, oh, totally. Like, I want people to have that feeling.
Yeah, totally. It's like Celino and Barnes and hydration.
You're like, sure, great. I didn't know it was going to be either of those things. And I think that makes it hard. So, like, we've done a couple episodes now that are actually about, like, 80s kid stuff. We did an episode about Chuck E. Cheese and, like, sort of the pizza wars. We've done an episode about the Cabbage Patch Kids. And so people will send emails being like, do something about Pogs, you know, like, and I get it. Like, that seems like something we should do, or Beanie Babies. But I'm like, no, we can't do it because like we've already done too much of that. So it has to be, it's not just even the topic. It's like the idea that I want it to be about has to be a new one, even if there's some overlap on topic. But yeah, it's like some combination of like, I kind of want it to feel like a trap door, you know, like when you squish on a trap door, there's like a little spring. It's like if it's the right idea, like you start to look into it and you're like, oh, there's something, like it's given a little, like I can't just, I don't know the answer from looking at Wikipedia. And also there seems like interesting possibilities and I have like some questions, you know?
How does that work from a process standpoint? Like, do you have 1,000 ideas that you're pressing on all the time? How often do you guys kill episodes? Like how does it work?
We don't. So process-wise, per episode, the process is actually very organic in a way that I think can be confounding. So this is how it's connected to being a critic, is like the thing about being a critic is, right, you're supposed to say something interesting about whatever, any subject. And then also like you find out a lot of the time what you think and what's really interesting and you refine it by writing. And I think that there is a huge amount of that that is part of the process of making an episode of Dakota Ring. Like I pick a topic. We're working on an episode about the tooth fairy right now. Okay. Like I think there's something there. Like there's a good there. We have a real question about the tooth fairy. And you start to push on it, but I don't actually know I don't know what it means. I don't know the argument that I make. And the only way I know is from talking to people and so, or thinking about it and reading stuff. So the scripts will be like, I'll be like, okay, I know where like the first two parts are going. I think I have a structure, but like, we're going to have to land this plane. I'm not sure. Like we're going to get there.
It's so interesting to hear you say that because, you know, I listened to all of these episodes over the last couple of days, and the topics are so disparate. So I listened to like the selling out episode about Franz and an Oprah. I listened to that Sideways story about like what was the real impact of that movie on the wine industry. The hydration one, I love it. Just like, why did we become obsessed with being hydrated all the time? Why does every child walk around with a water bottle? And then this one about your mom's friend who was this wonderful artist who never quite made it. Hugely disparate topics. But the thing that felt so consistent to me was the confidence with which you stuck the landing.
Thank you. Like, I honestly think that's like, I spent like 10 years being like, I'm going to make a conclusion about like a piece of television. And it's like, it's the same thing. It's like, I have to write you a critical essay at the end of this piece. And I know how to do that. Like, I've had a lot of practice. And I don't stress out about that part. And I know from working with other people that that can be hard. It's hard to say something at the end. And I'm like, I'll figure it out. And I do. And that's just from practice. Like, that's just because I did done it a ton.
What part about making the show is hard?
Oh my God, everything. What do you mean it's hard? Like, the thing, I think the reason the show is so, like, alive to me and so, like, I feel so in it still, even though we've been doing it, like, for 5 years, is because every single time I'm like, I have to do this from scratch. Like, do you know what I mean? It really, like, it isn't that formulaic. Like, I think it is, you know, like, I don't know, like, this happened. Like, we have a cold open. So, okay, I can write the cold open. It's super fun to write. But, like, it's not like I know what it's supposed to be. And it's also not like, I'm never talking to people and I'd be like, I need this here. Like it's just, I just don't, I have to go write it. And that's really hard. Like, the hard part is still the writing. Like, the thing that's so cool about making a podcast is, like, it hurts, the writing hurts. And then you get to, like, you put it on blocks, you know? Like, then you, like, get an audio cut. And it feels like when you send a written piece to, like, an editor and they give it back to you and you're like, oh my God, I have all this work to do. Thank you so much. But, like, I can see. Yeah, totally, totally. Like, I'll do this. It's like just getting in an audio is like that. You're like, oh my God, all this shit is wrong and I can fix it right now. Like, I hear it immediately. So, like, as soon as you get it there, then even when it's hard, you're like, well, at least I have a draft. Like, I'm going. And that part I find really fun.
How do you think differently about the writing in a podcast versus the writing you're doing for Slate or whatever?
I think they're similar and different. Like, I think writing still, like, writing is hard. Writing is fun. Writing is the whole thing, you know? Like, the show is really written. I think that you can get away with, like, a lot of, like, hacky shit you can't get away with in real pieces. Like, and actually, more than that, like, you almost need them. Like, obviously, you don't want to be, like, the thing you need to know about hydration is, or like, in order to understand that, you got to understand that, like, we can do a little better in like, our language in a podcast, but actually, like, you need to do some version of that. Like, it actually, like, not always, but there's a reason people do that. So, like, you can make your signposts more elegant, but, like, there is this sort of hand-holding that happens that I think, like, is sort of necessary. So, like, on the one hand, like, I kind of hate that. I'm like, this is so hacky. But then on the other hand, you're like, oh my God, it's so fun. I didn't have to, like, write an elegant transition. I could just be like, so, the thing you need to know is, I mean, I try.
Let's go back.
You know. Yeah, exactly. Before we can do this, we've got to do that or whatever. and you know, and, like, honestly, even just writing in the shitty version and then getting to go back and make it better, but just, like, literally knowing you just need a sentence, like, that is very freeing. Obviously, like, that's also what's really, like, when you do those really nicely, like, that's what's beautiful and fun about a written piece. But yeah, so that I really like reporting. I love reporting. I like getting to put it. It feels like it's 3D. Like, it just feels like it's a craft, kind of, like, in a more extreme way than writing, which is also a craft. But feels different to me. It's like sculpture versus painting or something.
Was it hard to find your actual voice?
So, no. This is like, I don't know why, but also this thing, like, do you remember you have to, like, do in school, like, presentations for, like, your class about whatever, you know, like, some history. You're like, you were assigned to, like, tell them about Constantinople, you know, whatever, and you have to do, like, 5 minutes about it. And I was always good at that because I was always like, I'll say this, like, slightly funny thing, and I know that everyone will laugh because, like, this isn't a stand-up comedy show. It's, like, a classroom, and everyone's, like, so, like, everyone wants to be on your side in that situation. And I feel like I always wrote how I talk, and so actually writing how I talk was easy. Like, I'm not saying, if you listen to the early episodes, like, I've gotten much better on mic and I have a much, all those things. But I did have some, like, innate sense of that stuff. And I don't know why.
Can you articulate what getting better on mic sounds like to you?
Yes. It's like being comfortable, like, knowing what your voice can do, like, throwing things away, like, just like using your voice to get people close, to make people laugh, to like tell them they should be paying attention, to tell them you're serious. All, like just a sort of just exactly what it is. You know, it's like acting, right?
Yeah. But I mean, it's, you know, it's always this, this, at least I find it to be this strange thing where it's like, today the character of Willa will be played by Willa. It's like, yes, part of what getting better means is like being more yourself.
You know, the thing is, though, that like I don't sound like myself on mic. Like everyone who really knows me is like, your voice intonations on mic are really weird. Like you don't talk like yourself. And it's true. Like if I'm reading a script, I think it sounds natural to people who don't know me, or pretty natural, but it's not how I talk like I'm talking to you. And I can't make those align. Like I don't know how. I would have to like really listen to how I really talk and try to figure it out. So it's not like, so it is a character, you know?
How do you think of yourself as a character on the show? Because one of the things that I found listening back to a bunch of episodes sort of back to back to back is that often in those endings in particular, you come in.
Yeah.
And part of the way that you stick the landing, part of the way that you make meaning of whatever the thing is to articulate at least why you were interested in it.
So I would just like straight up, honestly, like I haven't thought about this at all. And I actually think probably it's productive. Not like, I think it's probably helpful that I haven't like thought about this too much. Cause
let's talk about it. Let's talk about it some more.
No. I'm happy to think about it. But like, this is like first thought, worst thought, best thought. I don't know. Like it's not.
Yeah.
I know that I, like in other kinds of writing, I am sort of like, it's funny because we started with this piece where you were like, you wrote about how, why you became a TV critic. But I often have kept myself out of, like, if like reported pieces, I don't want a lot of I in them. Do you know what I mean? I'm conscious of it. And I think when I, as a critic, I learned that there's a way to deploy yourself that can be very cheap, but very powerful. It's like a cheat. Do you know what I mean? Like you can just mm-hmm. use yourself to stand in. And sometimes it's a trick, you know, but like, and sometimes it's a good trick and sometimes just a lazy trick, but you can do it. So I think I got a little more comfortable doing that and knowing those moments. I'm sure that that's informing stuff about the show, but like, I'm actually kind of like a guarded person. I'm a person where like, I'm not at all a guarded person, obviously, like we're having this conversation. I seem like myself and open, but like, there's like, I don't want to overshare about my like actual, like what I do with my life, you know, like my like private life. Not that there's, I just like, that's not, I don't like, I'm just never been that interested in it. And so I think in the show, it's like all just about ideas. It feels like a safe place to be like, I think this. I mean, the thing about the show is we don't kill a lot and we are small staff. So we have to like, we basically have to make them work. And like, one of the things about, if you don't do the thing we're doing, then the story has to have a end, right? Like you need a three act, like that's the killer of so many narrative stories. It's like, it's the killer of so many jokes. It's the killer of stories you tell your friends, you know, like what's the end? Like you have like the climax and then it's like, what's the last beat? Like This American Life, like they always have a incredible, gorgeous, hilarious, perfect last beat, which is certainly not why they kill so many things, but I'm sure contributes to it. Do you know what I mean? And our last beat is me thinking about it.
Well, do you want to make meaning of this conversation? Can you land the plane here?
No, definitely not. That's your job. I'm just a passenger.
Do you think you're going to do this for a long time? Do this podcast for a long time? Is podcasting going to be the forever thing?
I don't know. I could see it going a lot of different ways.
You might just start sort of hating it.
No, I mean, I think it's not like, I think it's different. It's like, it's not writing that I hate, right? And making a podcast like this, I can look at so many different things, you know? It just feels like I can look at water. I can look at, you know, whatever. Like, I can look at bustles. I can look
and
at...
You don't necessarily need to look at it for 10 straight hours on your couch.
Yeah, exactly. I get to talk to a ton of people. And so that way, like, it does feel just so much more like... It's just the scope is so much bigger. So in that way, like, like, yeah, I could do it for a long time. It feels different that way. It's so, who knows what's going to happen? Are you going to do this forever?
Willa, thanks so much for doing this.
All right.
But really, thank you for doing this. It was so much fun.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Seth Kelly edited this episode. Thanks to him. Thanks to Susan Peterson, who handled the show notes. Thanks to everyone at Vox, with whom we make this show. And thanks so much to Willa Paskin. Her podcast is called Decoder Ring. The new season is out April 12th. In the meantime, go back, listen to all of these episodes, particularly The Sign Painter. We'll see you next week.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art, Beats, and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art, Beats, and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.